So good morning.
Good morning.
It is my pleasure to introduce Professor Emerita Susan Boyna.
That's right.
Today
yes.
is October 21st, 2015. We are here at Albert Hall, and we're going to talk about Susan's career and life and anything else she wants to add.
Okay.
So welcome. Okay, so let's start at the very beginning.
Okay.
Tell us about your background.
Right, so without going into excruciating detail, I was born and raised in Quebec in the Eastern Townships, beautiful area. My parents were both from Nova Scotia. They moved to the Eastern Townships of Quebec after World War II, I believe mainly for economic reasons. My father worked in a factory. He very sadly developed a brain tumor and eventually died when I was just under five. My mother had been a school teacher, and although she had resigned from her teaching when I was born, she went back to work pretty much immediately after my father died. And so she raised me as a single mother, and a very strong woman, you know, not a flamboyant out there kind of person, but she was a great role model, I think, in retrospect, because she just decided, okay, I'm going to go back to work, I'm going to raise my child, and this was quite a small town in Quebec. She, a largely francophone town, my parents were anglophone, but a very strong English minority. She taught at the English school, of course, and so I got to go to school a year early. At 5 years old, they didn't have kindergarten at the time, so yeah, so that's a little bit about my family. Most of my relatives were in Nova Scotia, so we always went back to Nova Scotia every couple of summers, and that I mentioned because I now am living a bi-coastal life between Vancouver and Nova Scotia, so I'm feeling very lucky about that, to return to some of my roots.
What was your undergraduate training?
So after I finished high school, I went to, with some debate about which university to go to. I was quite young when I graduated high school, about 16. So I ended up going to a small liberal arts university in the Eastern Townships, Bishop's University, about an hour away from my hometown. I lived in residence for the first couple of years and pretty much enjoyed that. And I ended up doing, well, a mix of courses to begin with. I then was going to do sociology, but quite frankly, I was scared off by statistics. And I was already doing some history courses, so I ended up doing an honors degree in history, which I really loved. And I would say that that background in both sociology and history, I kind of had a minor, I guess, in sociology, has informed a lot of my legal work since that time. So that was quite pivotal, I think. I had great instructors, very small college, so you know, you get quite a lot of personal attention. Yeah, and I think perhaps moving on to one of the next topics, one of the reasons I went to law school is that, and because I was not one of those people who had a dream from a young age of going to law school or being a lawyer. That was not me. I had no lawyers in my family. Really didn't have much of a clear idea about what law was all about. But at the time I graduated from university, which was 1975, there were really very few job opportunities in universities in Canada for the humanities. And my professors, I had done quite well at university, they said, look, normally we would suggest you consider going on for graduate work in history or something like that, but you know, we know you don't have a ton of money, and frankly we're not sure whether there would be a job at the end of that. It's a little bit of a risk. So I was really, I was young still when I graduated undergraduate university, and I really didn't know what to do. At the time I had a boyfriend who desperately wanted to go to law school but didn't have the marks and kept telling me, it's not fair, you have the grades to go to law school and you don't want to go. No, I want to go and I don't have the grades. I also had a roommate, a woman who was in theater, who said that if she weren't in theater, she would think about being a lawyer. And so I had all these, you know, friends around me who were saying law, law, law. And so finally, for lack of a better idea, I applied to law school and I got in. So I went. And that, so I was an accidental tourist in law, I would say.
So tell us about your law school days. Where did you go and how was that?
So in the end, I went to McGill in Montreal, and it was fabulous to live in Montreal for a few years, of course. I went to law school in 1975 to 1978, and at that time, law schools were still closer to a kind of technical training than more of a legal philosophy or contextual training in law, seeing law in its social context. That really was not happening very much, and certainly not at McGill. So I must say it was a big shock to me coming to McGill Law School after having had a very interesting 3 or 4 years doing history and sociology and a little bit of women's studies, which was just a new area at the time. And I mean, I did well in law school, ultimately, once I found my feet, but I must say I did not love it. I, of course, met some good friends, a couple of whom are still very strong friends of mine, but for me, intellectually, I didn't absolutely love it. So I stuck with it. I guess I don't like to give up on things. So I did stay with it, and I had some interesting experiences, like working as a research assistant one summer for a family law professor. I worked for a local law firm in Montreal for a couple of summers in between years. So, you know, I had some good experiences, but I just wasn't loving it. Let's put it that way. Also, I was the sort of person who was walking up the steps of McGill Law School my first day thinking, what would a course called torts be all about? I had no idea what, I thought it was a funny term, but I just didn't, that shows you how little I knew about law. I had no idea what torts was going to be. Criminal law, contracts, you can kind of figure out. Torts, no clue.
So what kind of courses beyond torts did you take? What was your law curriculum like?
Right. Well, I, of course, at McGill at that time, one was required to do, I was doing the common law degree mainly, but I was also required to do some civil law courses because Quebec has always prioritized a bi-juridical approach to law, looking at both the civil law system and common law, which was a great thing. But it meant that we had somewhat less choice than perhaps some law schools offered at the time. I actually originally was going to do the so-called national program, as it was then called, in at McGill, which would have been a four-year program after which you would receive both a common law degree, LLB, and a civil law degree, but in the end I just did the 3 years with a smattering of civil law courses. For optional courses, yeah, I'm trying to remember. I do recall I did international human rights, and that was with John Humphreys, who is a very revered, respected senior human rights scholar in Canada who had had a lot to do with the United Nations when it was set up and some of the legal documents related to the United Nations. I did do a jurisprudence or legal philosophy course, but at that time, you know, there certainly was nothing like feminist legal theory or anything like that. It was a very traditional course. Trying to think what other kind of offbeat courses I did. I think otherwise I pretty much did the courses that, you know, you were told you should definitely consider doing for having success at the bar. And so I'm not thinking of any other. Oh, I know. Here's a one that's important. I did end up doing a course in European community law, as it was called at the time. That was a brand new area, the European community had fairly recently come into being. So I did do that, and that's important because I did eventually do a postgraduate diploma in European Community Law in Amsterdam right after law school. So that was an interesting, different thing to do.
And you graduated in 1978, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And what happened next? What did you pursue after graduating from law school?
So I wasn't a very organized law student, and career counseling then was not what it is now for law students. So I essentially went traveling in Europe the summer that we were all supposed to apply for articling positions. So I got back in August, and lo and behold, most of my friends had articling jobs secured for the following year already. You have to remember, this is pre-internet, pre-email, so it was, if you went away for the summer, you really weren't corresponding very much regularly with your friends and colleagues. So the long and the short of it is, I didn't end up getting an articling job for the following year. I did have an offer, but I wasn't very happy with the opportunity. So I just decided, okay, I'm going to do something else for the year after law school, which turned out to be this diploma in European Community Law in Amsterdam. Great opportunity, international program. I met a lot of people from around the world. And then I did apply, you know, at the correct time for articling positions, and ended up going to Toronto, to Bay Street, essentially, and I articled for half the year at Lang Mitchner, which is a much larger firm now. I think it was about 50 then, which was fairly large at the time, I guess. I was the only woman articling student out of, I think we were eight. Didn't love that experience, and halfway through the year, my partner at the time was in Ottawa, so I had been commuting, so I was able to transfer my articles to a smaller firm, Heritage Tolmie in Ottawa, and I was definitely happier at that firm, and they also allowed me to do a lot of legal research. They had two other articling students who really wanted to get out there and do the hands-on work in court when they could, small claims court, that kind of thing. I think by then I was not so sure I wanted to practice law. I wanted to do something with law. I wasn't sure what. So I was happy to take on the legal research sides of the job where I could. Of course, I did get a smattering of experience with the more practical issues, real estate, and so on. So I did my articling year, and then I, of course, had to do the bar course and bar exams, and I did get called to the Law Society of Upper Canada or Ontario.
Okay. And how did you get affiliated with UBC?
Okay, so that's a bit of a longer story also. So after I was called to the bar, I really wasn't sure what to do. My partner at the time was on sabbatical. He was an academic, and going to London for the year. And so I ended up going and doing a Master's of Law in International and Comparative Law. I think that was the year right after articling. So I did that. That was quite interesting, quite enjoyed that. Of course, got to live in London, England, which was amazing. And then I came back to Ottawa and thought, what am I going to do with this degree? I'll try to get a government position, which, of course, turns out to be easier said than done. You really have to network and learn, you know, find out who's around. And anyway, that didn't really happen. I did eventually get a position with the Law Reform Commission of Canada, as it then was, doing research mostly on criminal law. I think I did a little bit of, it was mostly criminal law. I did a paper on infanticide, which was interesting. And as I recall, something on arson. Anyway, I did some criminal law, which was not something I really thought about working in before. And I did that for maybe a year or so, and then thought, well, I really like the legal research, but I would maybe prefer to do research on my own agenda instead of on somebody else's agenda. Because, of course, at a law reform commission, ultimately the policy decisions will be shaped by the commissioners and the people who, not the legal researchers. So you have a little bit of influence, but you're really working for somebody else's agenda. So in the end, I ended up applying for academic positions in Ottawa, and I ended up teaching at Carleton University at their Department of Law, not a faculty of law. It was in a social sciences faculty. And I was there for the first few years of my career, and I absolutely loved it. I was terrified about teaching at first, but I found my feet. And I ended up teaching criminal law and family law, no international, because that was taken out by a senior colleague when he went on sabbatical. Sometimes I got to teach international. But the bottom line is I was moving away from the international law field that I had done my graduate work in. And somewhere in those years, I also started to teach feminist legal theory, which I enjoyed, and my research took off mostly in family law and also feminist legal theory or feminist legal studies. So that was a fantastic experience. It was a very interdisciplinary environment to work in. I loved it. History was upstairs, sociology was upstairs, geography downstairs. It was fantastic. And then, at a certain moment in time, I was recruited to apply for this new endowed chair in Women and the Law at the University of British Columbia. And at first I said no, because honestly, I never had had any thought of moving way out to British Columbia. I hadn't spent very much time in Western Canada at all. My ties really were eastwards, Quebec, Nova Scotia, etc., Ontario, of course. So, and then some of my life circumstances changed. I split up with my husband, got together with my still partner, and so I guess that opened up some ideas in my head. Well, where might I like to be? So I thought, okay, I'll come for the interview. And had a very interesting interview out here in March of, when would that have been, 1992, I guess. The cherry, of course, Eastern Canada, still covered by snow and ice. The cherry blossoms were out here. I had 5 days of just fantastic weather. Everyone who had a role in trying to recruit me to UBC kept taking me to beautiful locations in Vancouver. It was really quite funny. But what was most interesting was there was a strike on at UBC at the time. I think it was mostly support workers, and a number of colleagues at the Faculty of Law were not crossing picket lines. So what they did was they organized for all of the components of my interview, and as I recall, it went over 2 days, to happen off campus. So, for example, one day, Lynn Smith was the dean at the time, the first woman law dean at UBC. And she has a beautiful home quite near campus. And so in the morning, I would go to her house. She would leave and come to work because, of course, she was effectively management, so coming into work. And I would take over her kitchen, and faculty members would come to meet me. The appointments committee came to meet me there. I think I met with students, the Women's Caucus as well. And then it seems to me one other event was at Bill Black's home in Point Grey as well. And so that, I have to say, was quite fun because it made it feel much less formal. And so I had a blast meeting people. I think I did my job talk in Bill Black's house, actually. I think that's what happened. So that was one of your more unusual interviews. In the end, I did receive a job offer, and I was still unclear if I wanted to move from the interdisciplinary environment I had been in at Carleton University and move to a law school, but I was persuaded, as was my partner Claire Young, to come for a year as visitors. And by fall, I think colleagues here at UBC had realized that Claire herself was quite a catch. At the time, UBC was trying to recruit mid-rank to senior women, because women were very underrepresented at UBC, and including in the law faculty. And so colleagues such as Lynn Smith, Dennis Pavlich, Marley Klein, Joel Bakken worked very hard to find a way to create a position that Claire could then apply for. She did receive an offer, and so by Christmas, or maybe early January, we had decided to stay, to move to UBC permanently, and so that's what we did.
Great. So do you remember any particular conversations during your unusual job interview process?
My unusual job interview process? I'm not sure. I can remember. I think that really, honestly, the most striking thing is doing this interview during the strike. Mm-hmm. I do recall that two colleagues who shall remain nameless sneaked me into the law school. This was the old law school building, of course. One evening, just so I could, because I had never been to UBC before, so they wanted me to have a sense of the infrastructure, so to speak. That wasn't such a great experience because, as I think the workers here at UBC who removed garbage were on strike. So, the old building was not a beautiful building in the first place, and secondly, it wasn't very clean. So that was quite humorous. I remember slipping in the evening to check out my future work environment.
Great. So let's turn our attention to the law school itself. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us what was different between UBC Law then, your starting day, and now? Mm.
Well, a lot was different. The building, of course, is one of them. As I mentioned previously, we only had, I'm going to say, about 30, maybe one-third women on faculty. Female students were still considerably less than 50%, although that changed fairly rapidly. So just on a gender and diversity level, there have been a lot of changes in the law faculty. We are now approximately 50-50 female and male faculty members, same with the student body. In terms of other aspects of diversity, race, and so forth, Aboriginal status, that too has shifted somewhat, though perhaps not as much as it can do or will do in the future. UBC Law, I think, was in a real state of transition throughout perhaps the whole 1990s, and I think really struggling a little bit with its identity. So they hired this chair in feminist legal studies. That was me. We did change the name of the chair in due course. That allowed a sort of consolidation of energy that had already started with other feminist colleagues, such as, I guess the most senior at the time were Lynn Smith, the dean, but also Christine Boyle, now retired, Marilyn McCrimmon, who early retired a number of years ago. They were my kind of senior female feminist colleagues at the time. J.C. Smith, who was a male colleague, senior, very well regarded in legal philosophy. He was also working on feminist jurisprudence at the time. So Marley Klein, Nithya Iyer, they were all, more junior, but Judy Mossoff. We had quite a number of people who were working on feminist issues, but I think hiring this chair in feminist legal studies was quite symbolic in saying, okay, feminist legal studies is something that is happening now. It's maybe a little bit in its early years, but we want to consolidate our strength in that field. And I would say that's really what happened through the 90s. And, of course, we eventually ended up with a Center for Feminist Legal Studies, which mm-hmm. I became the first director of. And now I think it's fair to say that feminist legal studies is established as one of the strengths of this law school. So that is a big change. Mm-hmm. It's not that the field didn't exist when I arrived, but I think that has been a change that certainly has meant a lot to me and that I worked very, very hard on over the years. What other changes? I think the research culture has changed at this school. Of course, many colleagues were always doing research alongside their teaching and their committee work, but I very much think we have a stronger research culture now, both individual scholars working on their own things, but also collaborative work. Certainly, while I was still at UBC, I headed up two or three collaborative projects and was part of another one that Christine Boyle and Marilyn McCrimmon headed up. Around the time that I arrived, just after, we hired Wes Pugh, who had been a colleague of mine, funnily enough, at Carleton University. And Wes was a very strong, is a very strong scholar in legal history, but also law and society generally. And so I think law and society as well is a field that has developed a lot in strength over the last couple of decades since I arrived at UBC. And I think our new dean, Catherine DeVerne, certainly, well, I'm imagining she had something to do with the fact that we're now hiring specifically for a senior position in law and society. So I think that's quite symbolic.
And what about the workload? Has that changed since you started working?
So, yeah, that's an interesting question. So because I was hired as a holder of an endowed research chair, I had a one-course teaching release. So most people, when I arrived, were teaching four courses, approximately 6 hours a week each term. But the arrangement was made that research chairs, including eventually when we got some Canada research chairs, would teach three instead of four. So my course load pretty much remained as such throughout my career. But what has changed is for people who are hired into non-research chair positions, if you like, still the regular course load remains four, as I understand it, but we have, as a faculty, tried to assist, especially junior scholars, but really any new scholars, in adjusting to UBC, but also making sure that as they develop courses and teaching materials and so on, that they have time to research and publish and get research grants and things like that. Because the bar has really, I would say, been raised since I first arrived in relation to expectations for tenure and promotion. And so this faculty has definitely tried to make sure that especially junior scholars do have some support and some time to be able to develop their research agendas. Another aspect of workload, I would say, this has less to do with UBC, I think, and more to do with changing times. So during my career at UBC, technology really changed. So as I mentioned, I went through law school and most of my graduate work without the internet, without email. Email was just kicking in, I think, when I went to do my master's degree. Early 1980s. So that has changed things radically. We have fewer what we used to call secretarial staff than we used to. Faculty members are certainly expected to do much more of their own word processing and so forth, which was never a big deal for me, but I know for some senior colleagues it was because they had not learned how to type, so it's maybe a bit of a gendered thing. So that's just changed enormously, and I think what that has meant, or what it meant for me anyway, is I think you just ended up doing more of your own support work, if you like, as time went on. And the other thing I noticed was, certainly as I became more senior, a lot of expectations about doing committee work, doing the administrative work of keeping both the faculty running and also the university running. So I was on our appointments committee off and on for many years, graduate committee. I chaired the senior appointments committee at UBC for a few years and was on that committee for longer. All of those types of committees take an enormous amount of time if you take them seriously, and they are essential to the running of a university. And I guess I make this point because I think a lot of people external to the university, and perhaps a lot of students, have no idea of the fact that their professors have quite a number of work obligations above and beyond preparing for courses, for teaching and being in the classroom. And over the years, I've just noticed that's something that I feel expectations increased around committee work, and that I perhaps spent a disproportionate amount of time doing that. And it's just something that I think the public does not recognize.
So tell us about the Center for Feminist Legal Studies.
Uh-huh. So, as I mentioned before, when I first arrived at UBC, we certainly had quite a bit of feminist strength, both in terms of research, but also teaching to some extent. After I arrived, because I had a mandate to develop feminist legal studies as the chair, I developed a couple of new courses focused on women in the law or feminist approaches to law. And then during the 1990s, I spearheaded a collaborative research project, which was very much feminist legal studies in orientation. And so a few years after I arrived, a group of us started talking about, well, maybe it was time to make a proposal to have some sort of infrastructure as an umbrella over the different feminist initiatives that were happening, both in terms of teaching and research, and just really, I suppose, to heighten our profile or reputation in the field. And as a collective, I suppose, in addition to with our individual strengths. And so we ended up proposing to develop a research center, and I did a lot of paperwork around that. Lynn Smith was still dean at the time, and she was extremely supportive. So we eventually brought this proposal to Faculty Council, which approved it, and then it did go on to be approved by the university, so it is a university-recognized center. And somewhere around that time, Lynn Smith was soon to step down as dean, and I am not quite sure how she managed to do this, but she did secure some startup funds from the university. I believe it was from the provost office, which was really important, because it's one thing to have a center that is sort of like an idea, but it's quite another thing and a real benefit to have space where you can have meetings, where students can participate and meet to discuss issues, that kind of thing. And so the center were given some space in a building that was adjacent to the old law school building. And with these startup funds, we were able to renovate space so that we had a large meeting room, well, large-ish meeting room, and then we also had an office. That was technically the director's office, but as I already had an office, we usually use that office for the student coordinator to do her work. And so that was fantastic, and I'm quite careful with funds, and so I was able to save some of that money, so we were also able to buy a computer or two, you know, some bookshelves and furniture, that kind of thing. And I believe I saved enough money that we were able to support some of our expenses into the next few years, most notably hiring part-time a student coordinator, because anyone who is director of a center at UBC, it's a lot of work, and you do not generally get a course release or any reduction in your other workload in order to run a center. So it was really important for me as director. I was the first director, and I remained director until about 4 years ago, I guess. And it's really a huge asset to have a student to work with who can assist you in organizing lecture series and other events, and also to work with students and to get students involved. And that's what happened. Every year we would hire a part-time research assistant, essentially, to help with the coordinating of the center. And I have to say, I worked with many, many wonderful feminist students over the years. That was a real pleasure.
So would you like to mention any memorable students
uh-huh.
that you have
yes.
taught or mentored?
Oh, well, All right, so this is where it becomes risky because there are so many that I am only going to mention a few, and honestly, I've worked with so many amazing students over the years. Coming to mind is one student coordinator of the center, Agnes Huang, who is now practicing family law. I'm also a family law scholar, so I'm very thrilled whenever any of my students end up practicing family law. Kat Kinch, Katrina Pacey have gone on to do very interesting social justice work, really carved out careers that suited their interests in feminism and social justice over the years. I suppose what I'll mention next are three students who I don't believe any of them were ever coordinators for the Feminist Center, but they were in my courses, and one of them was my research assistant for all 3 years she was in law school. So this is a group of three women: Jillian Calder, she was my research assistant, Deborah Parks, and Kim Brooks. And I mention them because they all three graduated in the late 90s. I'm going to say 97, but I might be slightly off. And all three of them have gone on to become academics. Jillian Calder is teaching at the University of Victoria Law School. Kim Brooks is currently at Dalhousie University's Law School, Schulich, having just stepped down as dean. And Deborah Parks is currently at the University of Manitoba Law School. And I know they were quite strong friends when they were in law school, and that they remain so. So it's a great example of students who forged very strong friendships whilst going through their 3 years of law school, and then, you know, still remaining colleagues in that larger sense this many years later. So I do remember that. That particular graduating class, there were others as well. They had just a really, really interesting group of feminist students who graduated, and they've all been fantastic.
Great. So looking back, can you describe any notable colleagues you have had?
Memorable colleagues, risky answer,
yes.
Because so many. I already mentioned before, when I first arrived at UBC, my senior colleagues, Lynn Smith, Marilyn McCrimmon, Christine Boyle. Marilyn did early retire, and we all were quite regretful because she was an amazing mentor, and in her rather quiet way, such an intelligent force. One of the early feminists to teach evidence law, actually, which Emma Cunliffe, one of my junior colleagues who was also my PhD student, has taken up that mantle, which is fantastic. Let me see, who else? I mentioned Marley Klein earlier, who was pivotal in trying to persuade me to come to UBC successfully, and of course Marley very tragically became ill with leukemia and died, I believe, in 2001. That was a huge blow to our feminist community here. And she was just such an amazing colleague, both in terms of her feminist theory work, but also because of her dedication to exploring indigenous legal issues. And of course, this is another thing our faculty was already known for then, but that field has even more strengthened now. So she's someone I still think of and miss a great deal. I'll mention a second PhD student of mine, Fiona Kelly, who sadly is no longer here, but she, while she was here for the first few years of her career as a colleague, taught family law and sometimes feminist courses, and has now gone back to Australia, but she's someone I remain in touch with and recently published a book with. So she was just fantastic, and of course it's very gratifying when you supervise doctoral students if they do get academic jobs at a good university, and both of them wanted to stay at UBC at the beginning of their careers and were able to do so, and have just been amazing teachers and scholars and colleagues. So that was a very special moment in my kind of more senior career, watching people like Fiona and Emma come into academia and thrive. Oh, who am I missing? Robin Elliott, I have to mention, who's also, I believe, retiring at the end of this year. Somebody that I co-chaired the appointments committee with for some years, and that was just a fantastic experience. It's interesting, sometimes doing that type of committee work, you actually get to know colleagues who perhaps you didn't have that much connection with before, and that was a really, really special experience. I have to name Marianne Babinski, who, you know, certainly was very good to me when she was dean, and very supportive generally of the kind of work that I was doing. Wes Pugh, who's currently on leave, and I know I'm sure everyone misses him quite a bit, but he's, ever since I was at Carleton University, Wes has been an incredible colleague to me, and although he really is a legal historian, because I share an interest in looking back at our history in order to understand how we have gotten to the current situation, it's just been wonderful having Wes as a colleague. I should mention my partner, Claire Young, who has also been a colleague ever since we came to UBC, and although she works in tax law, I work in family law, we share a feminist approach to law and have on occasion co-authored articles, which is not always an easy thing to do with your partner, but in this case it was. I'm sure I'm missing many people. I've already mentioned our current dean, who I was part of the committee that recruited her to return to UBC in the early 21st century, and obviously that has served us very well with her now becoming dean. So there are just lots of people to mention. Isabel Grant, another feminist colleague who actually I do recall when I was dithering about whether to accept the offer that UBC gave me way back in 1992. I remember Isabel, who I knew of by reputation for her scholarship, but I didn't really know her, calling me and just being really persuasive about why I should join UBC. So there are many, many more, it's been a supportive faculty in many ways. I'm not going to say every single year or part of my career here has been positive or glowing. I think it would be hard to be an academic over that many years and say everything was completely perfect, but I have had many supportive colleagues. It's been great.
So you're now retired?
I retired at the end of June 2015, yes. So early months of that retirement.
So how does that feel, and what's next for Susan Boyd?
Yeah, well, right now it feels great. I think I have no regrets, but you know, I am still involved in two research projects, and I still have a couple of graduate students, and I examined a PhD dissertation at another university in the summer. So suffice to say, it's a rare day when I wake up and think, oh, I have absolutely no work to consider doing. And I'm just going to read a novel or go for a walk or whatever. So I'm having a wonderful time. I'm definitely prioritizing things that I love to do, like reading outside of my academic work, and hiking and biking and things like that. But I think I have not yet reached that stage where I just have to really think, what am I going to do next? So I think that might happen in about a year, so you can ask me then. I'm not really sure. Most people say to me, oh, of course you'll keep publishing and writing, and honestly, I don't know. Yes, for the next year, probably, because I have made some commitments, but we'll have to see what I end up doing. I'm not sure yet.
Great. So my very last question, do you have any advice for potential students in law? Looking back at your own career?
Oh, well, Well, actually, I just met with a former student of mine yesterday afternoon. She's now articling, and she also was a research assistant with me, Krisha Dhaliwal, and we just published a paper together that she helped me with when she was a law student. And one thing I was asking her was whether, given how busy she is with articling and doing PLTC, does she have time to keep up her friendships that she made in law school and to retain a kind of supportive cohort of young colleagues around her? And actually, she said yes, she has managed to do that so far. She also said she feels like her articling position is a very good one and she's not being worked absolutely to death the way that some articling students can be. So I think she has some time to take care of her, to nurture her support networks and so forth. But that is one thing that I have heard former students who've been out in practice for a few years say, that even if they let that network that they came out of law school with go for some period of time, they found it very valuable to pick it up again, because otherwise you can lose your soul a little bit, especially if you're not doing legal work that is completely exactly what you thought you were going to do. And then, you know, you just end up feeling a bit like a drudge or a technician. So I think my advice is, if you were lucky enough to develop a core group of student colleagues when you were at law school who shared your values, shared your interests, your aspirations for what you were going to do with your life and with your legal career, try to hang on to that, because I think it helps you preserve your soul. And I would say, I guess I would circle back to the Center for Feminist Legal Studies in that regard, because it has become, it's not just a research center, it is also a space, physical and metaphoric, where students who are who share social justice values, feminist values, not to say they all agree with each other all the time, but who share that general commitment to trying to use law to make the world better. That the center is one place where, in a large law school like this one, students can find friends. And so, yeah, I would hope for their futures that they are able to hang on to some of those connections, which I think can be really, really important.
And on that note, thank you very much.
Okay,
it was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. That was indeed a pleasure.